Digital has given every voice a platform. Will yours be heard? If there is one skill that everyone needs today, it's not just the ability to communicate, it's the ability to connect. My mission is to give you the communication skills you'll need to inform and inspire, sometimes using digital tools, but always with human outcomes. In this episode, we're saying things better with Lila Smith.
We have to cut through a lot of barriers. One is the fact that people's attention spans have gotten cut down so short that if we're going to communicate something, we have to be so effective that we're able to do what people used to do in an hour in a parlor face-to-face in like 0.3 seconds in a digital advertisement. So you want to give somebody that whole story. Your communication has to be supercharged.
Let's begin. Lila Smith was a New York City actress and an e-commerce director, 50% one and 50% the other. Now, in Dallas and traveling around the world, she's finally at 100% using both her acting and business backgrounds to advise people and companies on how to say things better. And it has brought her to our show. Welcome, Lila.
Thank you so much for having me. You know I'm one of your biggest fans, so this is very exciting.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. So I think what we should do is let our audience know all about Say Things Better. So tell us, what is Say Things Better? How did you start Say Things Better? And most importantly, how are individuals benefiting from it?
Sure. Well, Say Things Better, the name of the company really came from a few people using those words, mostly in the LinkedIn community, to say that, hey, Lila, you're a great communicator. What is it that you're doing? You always just say things better. that same phrase kept getting repeated to me. So I didn't come up with it. I do all of this branding work and helping people to come up with the names of their business and their messaging and all of that. But the thing is, like, I really didn't come up with my own. It was from other people saying that was something I did. So I took that phrase because I think your personal brand, it really is about what your reputation is, what other people say about you. So if other people were saying that I say things better, then I wanted to create a methodology to share with other people how I do that, what it is about me that allows me to communicate effectively. And it really comes from my acting background. So I broke down some of the steps that I used in acting work in the scholarly pursuit. A lot of people don't know how much work goes into actors being able to tell a story and get the audience to forget that they're in a theater, which is no easy feat. It's not like you can ignore it. You're in a seat, you're looking at a stage, so you're up against a lot. And so actors need tools to make sure that the audience does connect, does feel like they're part of a moment, does feel like they're looking in at real life. So we take our own real life and we use these tools to bring that out on stage and bring the audience with us. And I use those same tools to help businesses to connect with their audiences and to connect with each other, the people in an organization.
You know, that's so interesting. I really believe that there's a resurgence in people's awareness of the importance of communication. In fact, in the talent space, there's a gentleman named Josh Burson. He's a thought leader. And he talked about how communication skills are one of the most sought after skills in, of all places, the tech sector. So I was wondering, why do you think that is, that communication skills are so very important today?
Well, we used to have a lot of access to the full range of someone's communication. We did a lot of things face to face, or a lot of emphasis was placed on how beautifully you worded things. And people would write long things that people had attention spans for. So now we have a lot more that we're up against. Just like in theater, we're up against somebody's disbelief of a situation because they know they're in a theater. And if we want to communicate something to those people and bring them in, you have to cut through all that fiction. And here in our digital society now, we have to cut through a lot of barriers. One is the fact that people's attention spans have gotten cut down so short that if we're going to communicate something, we have to be so effective that we're able to do what people used to do in an hour in a parlor face to face in like 0.3 seconds in a digital advertisement. So you want to give somebody that whole story. Your communication has to be supercharged. You have to be that good in order to really get a message across in a way that's going to get a buyer to convert, or just a new connection to feel something about you that's beyond all the other noise that's out there on social media.
I think that's so fascinating. And in addition to that, communication isn't just about talking. And I think we take that for granted. For instance, you teach that different colors communicate. I was wondering if you could give us an example of that.
My web designer, Melissa Gerbero, she went through my website with me. And before we put it up, she asked me what colors I wanted. And this is not the first time that I've looked at this. I used to run an e-commerce department. So anytime we were trying to set a certain mood, we would pick one color as opposed to another. And you can talk to any stylist and they'll tell you the same thing. You walk into a room wearing red, you're making a statement. I have power. I'm the one in charge. I am comfortable with and am looking for a certain amount of attention. If you're using something like cool grays and light colors, it seems more calm. If you're using like light yellows or greens, then you get a little bit more energy into a feeling, but it's still calmer than bold, bright colors. So what you're communicating is what you want people to feel when they are in the moment, in the communication event of looking at your colors, of being surrounded by them. If you look at an office building and you go into each different office, the things that they have up on the walls, the colors that they incorporate mean something. The purple and orange that I use as the colors for Say Things Better, they tell a story not only because of the colors that I chose, but the proportions that we decided to use them in. So orange is really a highlight. It shows people that I have creative energy, and that purple shows calm, it shows maturity, it shows a luxurious environment. I'm not inexpensive to work with, so part of it is that I want people to know right away that this is a brand that if you're part of, it probably means you're taking something seriously enough to invest in it. Purple used to be the color of royalty, and so you're already creating an experience before anybody's ever heard any of the words you have to say or read any of the text on your site.
That's very interesting. So let me ask you something. When you're coaching a senior leader, in addition to helping them pick the right words to say and how to say them, do you also coach them on what colors they should wear?
No, I don't usually. I mean, I would say talk to a stylist if it's really important to you. I would bring something up if I saw a lot of pictures of her or him and I saw that what they were communicating with their look wasn't what they wanted to portray or wasn't achieving the same kind of goals that they're telling me that they have. So one example, my friend and client, Shar Auckland, she's a fitness trainer and a healthy behavioral coach. So she goes beyond just being a fitness trainer or a health coach. And she really asks those questions of her clients, like, what are your triggers and what's happening to you on your way to work that you've eaten a healthy breakfast? And by the time you get to work in your car, you're ready to have 3 cups of coffee and whatever donuts are out there and you've lost all resolve. So what are the behavioral triggers? She's very serious about what she does and she's very scientific. And she's very energizing and supportive and super smart. And for all the reasons anybody could ever want to have a healthy life, I recommend connecting with her or following her. But she had done these videos on LinkedIn that I looked at. And I noticed that her posture, for example, like she was kind of slumped over or she was laying down or she was lounging. And I said that what was being communicated was really more of a relaxed vibe, something that's not engaging. And I use this system called Verb Your Values, which I created based on some acting work to help people check their work and their communication. So asking her if her verbs, you know, her values in verb form are to activate, to mobilize, to educate, like if those are the verbs, and I'm not saying that those are, but those are not far off. Mine are to affirm, to connect, and to empower. So those are what I use to check my work. Is my communication doing this? And my communication is everything. So for her, does this video, does it mobilize people? Does it activate them? Or are they sinking into the couch while watching you sink into yours? Are they having an experience of your communication that results in the effect you want to have on them? So those kinds of things I do call out if I notice it, but I don't usually tell people, hey, wear this or wear that, unless it's really far off.
Yes, you know, that really reminds me of Amy Cuddy's work and her information around presence. So thank you for sharing that. That's really interesting. I think it'd be helpful for people, for instance, entering into the workforce to hear this. Let's shift for just a moment. I'd like to talk a little bit about your background in theater, and not just any theater, but New York theater.
I like that you qualified it, because it is a crazy place to be. You have to love it, right? Like, you have to, it's like being an entrepreneur. If you're going to go down that path and you're going to open the crazy door, you have to know that walking through that means you have to have on some crazy shoes and crazy armor. And you just have to be like crazy in love with what you're doing. Because if you can't say that honestly, that this is the only thing I'm able to do, I must do this, my life's purpose is to do this. If you can't say that, just don't do it. That's my advice to any potential New York actor. And actually, I'm not doing it anymore, because it really was only accessing, as you said before, like 50% of what I'm able to do and what I love doing. And I was only able to do it 50% of the time, because I also wanted to have a life and make money and use that other part of my brain. So it was definitely, you know, not to use the word crazy too many times, but it was just a crazy experience. You go through so much rejection that you become immune to it. So that's a good thing, that you really realize that it's not personal, but you also start to look at, what are my differentiators as an actor, and how can I lean into those things? Because those are going to be the things that get you a job. People talk about an actor's toolbox. So you have in your toolbox your training, the things that set you apart, your special skills section on your resume. Now, like when you and I talk about a resume, a lot of people think about your CV, where you have worked before, what your job duties were. The special skills section on an actor's resume might include things like breathes fire or can stand on one foot for extended periods of time, which actually my resume used to say, because I can and still can stand on one foot for a long time. But those are the things that can set you apart when you're auditioning for a show like Chicago. So when I was auditioning for a show like Chicago, the musical, and a lot of people have seen that movie now with Renee Zellweger and Catherine Zeta-Jones, that musical is very stylized, and the Bob Fosse choreography for it is a very specific kind of training that dancers work on forever. And you need to have something really top-notch to stand out in a sea of other dancers and actors who do the same thing in other actors and dancers who do the same thing in New York. So you have to find every way that you can to stand out, basically.
So Lila, what inspired you? What moved you early on to want to get into acting?
I had no choice. I was always like this, you know, or I didn't think I had a choice. No, there's no 6-year-old girl who says, you know what, I'd like to be a communication consultant. Like, you know, so you go with the things that you see. You go with the people who are playing what you think is make-believe. And, you know, when you think of make-believe, a lot of people think of pretending. But when you say make-believe, and you just take those words, what you're doing is you're making someone believe, and you are making yourself believe. And we believe the things that we feel are true, and we find those things true because someone has communicated them to us, or we've communicated them. And a lot of that, in terms of the way our human brains process information, is through storytelling. I've always, my whole life, felt like I am a character in a storybook. I am this true, whole 100% person, and I'm just walking through the pages and experiencing things, and there's an audience, and there are people to connect with, and there are adventures. And so little Lila was always on this whole journey that I felt everybody was a part of. You know, Shakespeare said all the world's a stage, but that's really how I felt. And my parents really had no choice but to get me into acting classes, dancing classes. I did the circus for a summer. And in my high school, I was part of one of the best theater departments in the country at Edward R. Murrow High School in Brooklyn. And it was a program that people would come to from different parts of the city. You had to audition to get into it. And being there, being part of that program, it gave me so much of a foundation for work ethic and creative structure and teamwork and getting along with people and experiencing different kinds of stories, different kinds of people. So every character being its whole own valid, true story. And it builds that empathy muscle that when you see somebody else, you recognize them as somebody else who has their very own whole reason for being. And as marketers, you know, we do things to connect to that person in their whole story. So anything can connect. You just have to pick the right things from your story that connect with theirs.
You know, I'm pretty certain anyone listening to this is making connections to the business world. And I'm thinking about entrepreneurs and senior leaders who are in droves taking improvisational classes, acting classes to help enhance their communication skills. I wonder if this is something new, but you know, I read a lot about it. And also I was wondering if you could, in addition to what you've been speaking about, you know, before, maybe walk us through one or two best practices that you would use in the theater that you can, you know, transfer or port into the business world.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So for improv, which I think the business people that you're talking about, they go through improv training. Improv is short for improvisational, which means that you are making things up on the spot. And a lot of times you're doing that in teams where you have somebody else that you're playing off of, kind of like I'm your podcast guest. So you and I are having a conversation, and best practices would not be to negate something that the other person said, but to do what's called yes and. And that's a trick that people can use in business, in any kind of communication, where if you want to keep somebody on your team, keep them on your side, don't just shoot them down. Don't shoot down their ideas. Find a way to build on top of them until you can build the path back towards where you want to be. So yes, that's a great idea to talk about that. Let's do that by doing this thing that I say, so that you're still affirming what they've brought to the table and then expanding on it. And it's a great way to encourage innovation in an organization. It's a great way to encourage teamwork. And it's a great tool too for coming up with things on the fly. A lot of presenters will do it if they're up in front of a big company and somebody has a question and it comes out of left field or it takes them by surprise and they don't know how to answer it. Having improvisational training means that you do know how to answer, or at least how to buy yourself time in a way that's still going to connect. So I think it's totally worth it. I think it's a new-ish thing. People have probably been doing it since about the 80s in theater, although improv has been around for a long time, and doing that in a business setting. But now I'm trying to bring more of the scholarly tools from theater to businesses. So not just improvisation or performing, but a lot of people don't know what goes into acting before we even stand up on our feet and say lines out loud in rehearsal. And a lot of those tools come from dramaturgy, which is our way of researching the world of a play. So just like in marketing, you're researching the world of your customer, you're researching any kind of digital behavior that can lead you to classify them one way or another, to opt them in or opt them out of a campaign, where you're saying, here's everything we know about this person, creating an avatar for everything you know about them. Well, actors are doing the same thing with the characters that we have to play. We owe it to the playwright, to the director, and to the audience to bring our entire truth to that one character. And you're going to do the same thing if you're marketing to a customer, if you're marketing to somebody who you've created. But you have to create them from what you know. So you're looking at maybe web behavioral data, you're looking at other sites that they've liked, other Instagram accounts that they follow, and you're creating a story and filtering people through that like data sieve to get them into the end of your funnel. In acting, you're looking at the script. You're looking at what do other people say about this character in the script? What do the stage directions tell you? What can you interpret from the way that the character's language is formatted? Do they use short words or long words? Do they ask a lot of questions? Are they described in the stage directions as storming onto a scene? What does that tell you about them? So it's a lot of research before we ever decide which parts of our own personal stories as actor humans are we going to bring to this story to bring it fully to life?
This is so interesting. I really want to take one of your classes now, but I know we'll get a little sample a little bit later in our conversation. But I'd like to switch gears for just a moment, and I want to talk about LinkedIn. You have had a very successful run on LinkedIn. You have a significant following, and you've created some remarkable videos that have garnered a lot of attention and praise, frankly. And LinkedIn is how you and I connected. I was wondering if you could tell us about your relationship with LinkedIn.
Oh, okay. So, you know how you said 50% of me was in acting and 50% was in e-commerce? Well, I'm a pretty happy person in general. So even 50% felt like glass half full. And that's a pretty okay way to walk around the world. The danger was that I didn't realize how much I was missing in any moment. And yet I felt in some way, I have so much power and I have so much creativity and these great ideas, and they don't seem to all be fitting anywhere at once. What am I doing wrong? What am I missing here? I felt just fine, but not incredible. Certainly not like lit up and fulfilled with my whole heart and soul the way that I am now. So I set myself a goal that I was going to go onto LinkedIn for 15 minutes a day, every single day, starting June 1st, 2017. And that's what I've done. I haven't missed a day since then. Not one day, not days of funerals, not days of religious holidays, not a single day. I've been on LinkedIn every day for 15 minutes a day at minimum. Although honestly, it's more like hours if I really look at the time that I put in. But what I'm doing there is building relationships with people who reflect things back to me or who I can pour things into. And that's how I really use my strengths, my value, and how I find other people to connect to whose values align with mine. So you and I connected on LinkedIn, and I mean, I've connected with a bunch of people on LinkedIn, but what I noticed about the things that you were saying is that you're a really smart person and you can say things in a way that people feel comfortable, that it's casual enough, but I know you really know what you're talking about and you have the intellectual goods to back it up. Those are the kinds of people that bring out the best in me, the most special parts of myself. So surrounding myself on purpose with the people that I knew I could find more of on LinkedIn than I was finding on Facebook meant that that was where I was going to be spending more of my time. So I invested in it for professional and personal growth. And that's how it happened.
So first, thank you for those kind words. So is that the secret then to engagement? You talked about finding like-minded individuals and commenting on their work and exchanging and contributing to their work. Is that really the secret then?
Yeah, that's the secret. That's the whole thing. You're looking for those you have an affinity with. And even if it's people you completely disagree with about a lot of things, but you have conversations with them that you're able to respect each other or bring things out in each other that fill out each of your understandings of the world and of your place in it, that's also part of growth and expansion. So you find the people who you're aligned with, not just because they share your ideas, but because they share your values, like my value for clean quality debate. For example, so my friend Anton Chumak, Andrea Kov, and I, we used to get into these back and forth debates all the time about stuff, but I just love him. He's so smart. I don't have to take things out of my schedule. I don't have to stop doing things. I can actually add things in to balance out potential stressors, or I can realign myself where I'm using 100% of my heart and soul instead of 50%. So there's less pressure on that downtime to fill my tank all the way back up, because my tank is never all that empty. So getting to meet people like him meant opening my eyes and listening and watching and taking in the cadence of other people's communication and just seeing what it is that resonates with us. If you put your hand on your heart, like physically, if you're listening to this and you just put your hand on your heart and connect to your body and to your heartbeat, and you feel physically what your responses to things are for a minute a day, you'll start getting really clear on who the people are who bring out the positive in you and who the people are who bring out the negative in you. And I don't mean a disagreement, but I mean like your lowest self, where you are triggered all the time, where you're not being kind, where you're not being supportive for helping somebody else grow. That's what I mean by the negative. So if you can find the people who bring out the positive, who you make you want to challenge them, but in a positive way, for the purpose, for the objective of bringing you both closer together and providing more value for the community, then I think you have such a winning formula for building your network.
So I had my hand on my heart, by the way. I want to shift for a moment and talk about the effect of digital communication and what it's like today. A few weeks back, for instance, I had an interesting conversation with a friend of yours, actually, Kimberly Afonso.
Oh, I love her.
She feels the same
way. You talk
to
the best people.
Thank you. I know. I'm very fortunate. You know, it's funny. She was saying, you know, you really need to speak with Lila. And I'm like, I know I'm trying to get there. But anyway, we both agree that there is a lot of communicating going on in the digital space under the political realm. But the effect that it was having was an effect that was not conducive for clean debate, that did not promote growth, but perhaps would inhibit growth, and certainly did not build consensus. So I was wondering, how do I have the right qualities so that I can have those positive effects and perhaps help others to do the same?
I love that you're asking, how do you do that? Like, what can you do to take responsibility for that? Because that is all I talk about, is how does each one person or each organization, how do we lead? How do we lead if what we've noticed is the communication that's out there doesn't jive with us? It doesn't make us feel like our values are being represented. So what I say is that it is on you. It is your responsibility to guide the conversation. So you start the new conversations and you set up communication agreements and you say, hey, I'm going to have a group call on this podcast. I'm going to host a debate and I'm going to be the Say Things Better moderator. Anybody who's coming up in any kind of local or national elections wants to engage Say Things Better to set this up for them. I would love to do it. The format of debate is different because we're not trying to take down each other's ideas or take down each other as people. That if we're going to have a debate, it's about how to connect, where to find convergence, where to find confluence, and then move from there into a place of, if we must legislate, what are the things that we definitely can agree upon, and just start making smaller decisions. We, you know, in our government in the United States, if there are any international listeners, what happens a lot of times is these laws get passed that have a lot of extra little laws stuck in there just to get support behind them from all the people that you need to get a vote passed to even include something in it as a topic of conversation. And I think that that's where politically we fall off from the original democratic model. But, you know, as Americans, we're busy and where there are a lot of us. So we've chosen a republic model of representation. Which means that we elect officials to speak on our behalf. But those people also have so much that they want to get done that they're trying to cram it all in at once. And often that happens in debates too, where you try to talk about one issue and that keeps going off the rails. So the communication event of this debate has communication agreements that you say the moderator's role, which is the person who takes responsibility, and that person is assigned by the organization who's hosting this debate. It's your responsibility as this podcast host to create communication agreements with your guests that they know how to behave here. So it's the same with any kind of debate. If the topic goes off the rails, or if somebody starts to insult somebody or bring up something personal, it's the moderator's responsibility to bring everything they can and everything they have to the table. Not just to say, hey, I think you could be behaving better, but to say, hey, I'm going to pause us now because what I'm hearing is something we classify as personal. And what I'm hearing doesn't feel like it falls underneath our communication agreements. We've picked verbs as our values here to connect, to educate and to converge so that we're finding those things. If your communication isn't doing that, I'm going to call the conversation and bring in a new topic. So as the moderator, that's something that you can do. And having done the research too, to back that up and say, hey, you know what? There was an issue that I can use as an example here in Texas, where I'm recording this from. There was a boy who brought a clock to school that he had made. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the clock boy debacle? So look, you know, it's very easy for us to judge and say, it was just a clock. He's just a kid. You made generalizations, but there's a lot of high stress in managing a school district and ultimately wanting to keep people safe, no matter what people think about you. So I understand that that is the place of desperation from which decisions were made that ended up making this boy feel really terrible about himself and making the school district look really bad. Mm-hmm. So there were these debates that followed to say, should they have handled it this way? Should they have handled it that way? And what I saw in my research of this is some of the leaders who made decisions for how to handle it dug in their heels and started talking about things that were not the relevant information to make a point to get people onto their side. And also, it wasn't helpful in making a protocol to move forward. So there was no solution and the communication was getting muddied. So if I'm reformulating that debate and I'm hosting them, I host the leader of the school district, I host the parents or a group, maybe it's the ACLU or somebody on the other side, whoever the people are who disagree about how something was handled. The objective of the debate is not to pick one winner, unless that winner is society. So if what we're choosing is to benefit the students, to keep people safe, to have a school system where we can trust and empower our leaders to make decisions, that's where our goals should be. Not about winning or losing or putting people down, but the debate should be about finding the places that we can agree and mapping out then a communication strategy that includes everybody and start from there. It's not going to be perfect, but when people talk about going across the aisle, that's mm-hmm. one of the ways that I feel we can do that.
I did not know you specialized in debate. So with that, I'd like to pivot and move to the portion of our show that we call What If. So it's a scenario-based question, and it can range from the humorous to the bizarre and everything in between. But I always base the question on the answers that you've already provided. And so I think this will be interesting. So for those who are listening, today, the day I recorded this, is the first day of the new Congress in the United States. And without a doubt, there will be spirited debate on a variety of subjects. So Lila, what if members of Congress gave you a call and say, hey, listen, we heard about Say Things Better. We know that you specialize in debate, and we want you to come and give us a workshop on how we can improve our debate here in Congress. What would you do? How would you approach that situation?
Oh, well, my first call is to my lawyer, Sumitria Goodson, just to say, like, hey, this is a new thing. I need to copyright some stuff because I'm going to be passing it around and I'm going to be licensing this. So there's only so much that you can do with intellectual property when something is an idea. But in terms of its implementation, my first call is to her. Now, I love the law, clearly. I mean, I actually carry a copy of the United States the Constitution on me at all times. So that's a little trivia about Lila Smith. But so my first call is to her to say, here's what I want to do. I want to give my structure of debate to governmental entities. They're going to have to license it out. What does that look like? How do I charge for that? And how do I make sure that the Say Things Better name is still part of the conversation when they say we're hosting a Say Things Better debate? The same way that people say we're hosting a Lincoln Douglas debate, let them say we're hosting a Say Things Better debate. And what does that look like? So there is a formula, there is a format. And when I go in to actually do this workshop with them, once we've gotten over like, okay, you have to pay me and this is what that looks like, and I'm actually there doing it, I'm there in front of a room of people who are going to be hosting the conversations that are going to make a difference for our country. That to me would be a tremendous honor. So I take it very seriously. I take all my work very seriously. We have a lot of fun, but we have fun because we have these agreements. So one of the first steps that we would set up is about what communication agreements do all parties need to enter into before they're even allowed to participate in this debate. And I would help them walk through what those things are, what that looks like, and what the structure will be in terms of timing, responses, how much time do they have in advance to prepare responses, what is the conversation, and also to agree on a common goal so that both sides are on the same page and they're not ambushed. Because I think that that's not helpful. It's not productive. We're not looking to see ultimately who's the better arguer. We're looking for the best ideas. So the kind of conversations that I want to set up are really about being in a safe place, kind of how in acting, all the creative people have to come to the stage in a rehearsal prepared to be very vulnerable and exposed and bringing our own stories, our own lives, our own emotions to the table in service of telling a story that we all agree is important. So when the director gives us their vision and they say, this is my purpose for doing this play this way, are you on board with telling this story? You have the option as an actor to say, yes, I want to be considered for that role, or actually, no, I don't. It doesn't align with me or my values. And same thing with debaters. I think if you're not willing to come to the table and agree on what that common objective is, then you're not going to be a really effective part of the conversation.
That's fantastic. And clearly, you don't have to be in politics to employ those best practices. They work in a classroom, in a boardroom, and certainly in one's own personal room. So thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
So, boy, you got into like the political nerd part of me that no one ever has accessed on a podcast before. This is going to be the podcast that we listen to, you know, 10 years from now when I'm running for president of the United States. And you're like, it started here in a WeWork conference room recording on Anchor.
Okay. Well, speaking of the future, where would you like to be 5 years from now?
5 years from now, I want to have licensed the Say Things Better method of consulting to an additional probably, I don't know, 200 and 250 Say Things Better consultants so that my work can be expanded all around the world so that people can be connecting in a way that is ethical and sustainable, not just with their customers, but with their employees, with their families, and seeing it in application across cultures, across barriers, across communication touch points like technology or face-to-face or written communication. I just want to see it everywhere. I want to be in 5 years personally speaking about it, spreading the word and getting people on board with intentional communication, being accountable and taking personal responsibility for the role that communication has in the effect we have on people.
So I guess then, say 20 years, you want to be running the White House?
You know what I really feel like? And this is like, I should never say this just in case I have to run for president someday. But I don't know if I really want to be president the way that our government is currently set up. Like, I think I'd be a really great dictator. Like, if I could just say, look, y'all are getting it wrong. Here's how it's going to be. You'll thank me later. You know, because I said so, if I could rule that way, I'd have no problem. just be like, here are the solutions. Okay, ready, go. Then right now, that's an easy yes for me. It would take a lot. It would take a lot because I also don't know if I would be able to use 100% of myself the way that I am now in that kind of a role. And I totally believe now in using my UMAP, which is something that Kristen Sherry developed, to use my strengths, my values, my motivated skills, which are the things that I'm good at and I like doing, and just the way that I'm wired, which I'm an AE, an artistic entrepreneurial enterpriser. So those are the things that make me who I am and make me good at what I do. I don't know how I would be president with that UMAP totally activated. If I could work with somebody who would help me see that, then maybe.
Well, I, for one, think that would be a demotion for you being president. I think you have a much higher calling ahead of you. To your point about taking a more authoritarian approach that seems to be going around these days. So you're not alone.
People just aren't honest about it, right? Like, everybody wants to call the shots, but they're not honest about it. They're like, I'm here to serve the people. And then they just don't do that. Exactly. They just don't serve the people. And it's not necessarily because they wouldn't. It's that the structure of how it's set up has a lot of challenges. So where I feel right now that I can provide the most value is in those moments of challenge. The things that prevent us from being our highest, most ethical selves in politics and governing, to find ways of connecting and doing something positive. And even if it's doing something small, like let's find a law that we can all agree on. Like we all basically agree, we don't allow people to kill each other, right? So, okay, it's not like groundbreaking. It's one of the commandments if people follow the Bible, but it is something we all agree on. So we've made a law. No one's allowed to kill each other. Now we have to think about, okay, well, what happens if someone does? How do we punish that? What are the punitive damages? What are, you know, is there the death penalty? And that's where we get into some disagreement. But we agree, for starters, that no one should be killing each other. So find those places of agreement and start there. Just start with, hey, we agree on this. Make that statement. Start purposefully, intentionally communicating about the ways that we are similar. And the ways that we are different will start to feel less personal, less like an attack, and more like, oh, that thing that's different about them. I can understand that they are different, but I know at least all the ways in which we are the same. Because ultimately, we're all human beings. We all have values that we share. And no matter whose religion or whose government is the rubric for how we live, we align on so many more places than we diverge.
Well, without a doubt, anyone who takes on Say Things Better is going to benefit. So if folks want to learn more about you, where can they go?
They can go to saythingsbetter.com. They can email Lila at saythingsbetter.com. It's Lila. They can find me on LinkedIn by looking up the hashtag Say Things Better or the Say Things Better company page. And you can also find me on Instagram at Lila Lasagna and at Say Things Better and on Twitter. So you can find me. I'm around.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to be looking for you, and I'm glad I found you. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you for bringing out all my nerdy sides.
Well, we like nerds here. Hey everyone, that's it for our show this week. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others on social media. And if you are so inclined, please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you so much for all your support. I'll speak to you soon.